On the Human Podcast, I'll be bringing you interviews with both people you may know and people who have never been interviewed before in their life. I'll be asking them about the stories of their lives and helping you to understand who they are and why. Okay, so I'm super happy today to be joined by Julia Willemines, who is the co-founder of the Centre for British Progress. Julia, thanks so much for speaking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with what you're doing at the moment, which is, yeah, you're a co-founder of the Centre for British Progress, a new, pretty new organisation. Can you outline what you guys are getting up to there and what you're trying to do?
Yeah, so we launched last week, which was super, super exciting. And we are a nonpartisan think tank. Our aim is to accelerate and shape an era of British growth and progress. So what does that look like? Our ultimate goal is for the UK to have the highest living standards in the world and also lead at the frontier of global scientific, technological, and industrial progress. To do this, we research and produce concrete ideas and implementation-ready policies to make it easier to build the future in Britain.
I will start off with like a basic question, because I think some people watching this will have heard this phrase think tank many times before, but I've noticed that some people often say, I don't quite know what that is exactly. So what is a think tank? And this other phrase, nonpartisan, what does it mean to be a nonpartisan think tank?
Its most basic form, it's a group of people, often or ideally experts, researching different issues and then providing advice and ideas on specific political or economic problems to government. Often think tanks are charities or nonprofit organizations, I would say like 90% of the time, if not higher. So they're supposed to be giving impartial advice. If you're a charity in the UK, you have to be nonpartisan. If you're a think tank that's also a charity, typically you don't have any political affiliation. We're nonpartisan both because we're a charity, but also because we think that our goals, so human progress and material advancement, are not particularly party political. So that means that we're ultimately working with people across the political spectrum, although we do, just because we care about policy impact, focus mostly with working with whoever's in power, because they're the ones that ultimately have power over the policies that this country implements. So we do a lot of work with the current government.
Okay, great. So yeah, let's get into kind of a bit more specifics around what you're planning to do. So I mean, firstly, this word progress in your title, Centre for British Progress, how do you think what progress is and what kind of progress are you hoping to encourage in Britain?
Ultimately, what we care about is human progress, which might seem like a vague term, but that looks like lifting living standards, broadening opportunities, giving people freedoms to build better lives. And we think that human progress depends on material advancement. So the ability for new technologies to be developed, infrastructure to be built, products to be built, things to be built that expands human capability. And to have material advancement, we think you need economic growth. So that's why we're so focused on economic growth and also scientific and technological progress, not because these things are an end in themselves, but because we think these things expand our capacity for true human progress. And as this has historically been the case in the UK, and we think that we want to sort of rediscover that ability that the UK used to have to expand human progress through material advancement and through economic growth.
So how exactly do people working in the think tank try and take these ideas, some of the things you've just said out there, like, and take them and actually turn them into like some real tangible impact? How do you go from the thinking to getting things actually happening? What's the process there?
Everyone's got different theories of change, I guess. We do about 80% of really focused research on tangible implementation-ready proposals for policy change. So our theory of change is that actually we don't have to just answer the what and why for government, but you should also be answering the how. So not just why you should have a particular policy or what the policy should be, but how are you actually going to implement that policy? And I think that just not all think tanks think about that question. And then about 20% of what we do is more about building a movement. So inspiring people to think about growth and progress differently, showing people how technological and scientific advancements can actually have positive impacts on their lives, and increasing the agency and ambition of individuals. So when it comes to like specific policies that we do research into, which I guess is what a lot of people are interested in, we're really focused on getting demand signals from government. So it's not really useful if you're doing research into policies you don't realistically think are going to be within the Overton window, or like within what government could realistically consider. So we're very focused on this concept of the policymaker as the customer. So you need to have that demand signal before you build a product that you think reflects like your own internal values and the things that you're trying to get done. And then, you know, you try to sell this to the policy maker. But I think that's one thing most think tanks overlook, that demand signal aspect.
Okay, great. Let's look at maybe a couple of these different stages of the process. So firstly, when you're doing your research and you're thinking about the kind of things that you want to take forward to try and get implemented, like how does this begin? Does this begin with just a lot of thinking and reading and discussion as a team? Like where do these initial ideas come from?
Yeah, I'd say about 80% of what we produce, we have some form of direct demand signal from someone in government that it would be useful. So we'll like talk to people in government and say, they kind of know what we're about. We're about economic growth and scientific and technological progress. But we have expertise in particular areas, for example, science policy or energy policy. But we'll go into and talk to someone in government and say, what would be helpful to you? What topics do you need more support on? Let's say they give us a topic. Let's say it's something that's like interesting, geothermal, right? Next generation geothermal, it's a new technology. Not many people are thinking about it in the UK. And government probably doesn't have the expertise to really consider this new technology. So what we'll do is they'll say like, this is a topic we're interested in. What we'll then do is go back and both using our internal team capabilities, but also our network of fellows and other people in our network, come up with research on that topic and then present it back to government. I'd say like about 80% of what we do is like looks like that. 20% is we're sitting and thinking about these really tough questions around economic growth. Mostly the 20% comes from the economic growth questions. And we'll do a prioritization scheme where we think about like, what's the likelihood of this being implemented? How significant would this be for economic growth? And then we'll go down this like list of all of these ideas and say, okay, like we should look into these issues. So one example of a issue that wasn't necessarily commissioned by government or informally commissioned by someone within government is this piece that will come out in a couple of weeks on business dynamism in the UK. So we built out a whole database on looking at the rate of businesses being created and shut down in the UK, really based off of this economic idea of creative destruction. And we found that the rates of business dynamism in the UK are actually a lot lower than comparable nations. So that's a piece of economic research that's a little bit more academic. It doesn't necessarily have a policy recommendation associated with it, but it's going to form the basis for more policy research that we're going to be doing down the line, especially when we're getting that direct demand signal from government.
So is a lot of the way that governments, politicians, and so on decide what to do next informed by lots of organizations like yourself going to go into them, suggesting ideas, speaking to them, and so on?
I guess it would depend on the government. Rishi Sunak's government was very led by think tanks as well. So Onward was very influential. I think the benefit of a think tank is they're able to play with ideas that are a little bit stranger or a little bit outside of the orthodox thinking within the civil service. They're also able to think about the politics of a particular idea in a way that the civil service, because they're meant to be impartial, cannot. And they have more flexibility to use particular resources in their research that maybe the civil service doesn't have access to. We also tend to be like smaller teams, more dynamic. That's like kind of like naturally happens when you're comparing a small team with like a larger organization. So I like, not all governments use think tanks. I think governments probably should use think tanks, and at least consider advice that think tanks provide. But that's not necessarily a given within the system.
This other part, like kind of movement building, it sounded a bit more, it's like a little bit different, more in terms of like encouraging individuals to behave in certain ways. Can you say more about that and what that involves exactly?
You can get quite a lot done by just encouraging ambitious individuals to do ambitious things within policy, but also outside of policy. There's this concept that an ex-boss of mine used to always talk to us about. So Tom Khalil, he directed the Office for Science and Technology for Obama and also worked for Clinton. He always talked about policy entrepreneurs. And actually, that if you seed these really ambitious people with ideas and empower them, you can get a lot done. And I think that that's something that's really interesting to do as an organization, and something a little bit different from what think tanks typically do. So I think when we think about building a movement, obviously it's about empowering policy entrepreneurs, but I think it's also about empowering cultural entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs that are also working in the private sector or in the public sector. People who have ideas and really need an on-ramp for agency. I think that like following down that path, you can actually end up with lots of like sort of outsized impact. So that's what we think about a lot as well. I think Francis Bacon did this really well. You know, as like one of the first martyrs of progress, and he really was able to sort of change society for hundreds of years just by seeding these cultural ideas that were pro progress or pro scientific advancement, pro moral advancement. That's kind of what we are trying to do. I don't purport to be as influential as Francis Bacon, but even if we were able to shift the dial by 0.5%, I think that's a worthy cause.
And what are some of the ways that you actually try and encourage like ambitious individuals though? Is this by like trying to get them into certain kinds of employment, get them onto fellowships, give them money? Like, what does this actually look like on the ground?
So we're still trialing this. Our founding athlete, to some extent, did a little bit of this. So setting out sort of a cultural, like it wasn't a technocratic policy paper. It was more setting out a position or a worldview. So I think I see our founding essay as maybe our first attempt at this. We're playing around with lots of different things. Like, I think we're going to have an essay series on Substack where we invite external people, but also internal people to write pieces about progress that are more about values and ideas and less about technocratic policy fixes. I think I personally do this quite a lot. So I'll meet with people and try to help people get their ideas funded. Especially for people that aren't necessarily building for-profit organizations, but that are trying to enact change in like a way that's a little bit different from what our current structures look like. I think there's a lot to be done with this 20%, but we did launch last week, so still figuring that out.
Sure, early days. So let's just take like a bit of a broader look at Britain as a whole. How would you summarize how you think progress is going is happening in Britain in the last few years, last decade, as opposed to like previous decades? I know you've talked a bit about this in your kind of opening essay, but it'd be good to hear your thoughts on the state of things.
Yeah. In many ways, the UK built the modern world. And we like to start with that positive story, right? Like we discovered the theoretical foundations of electricity, antibiotics, computing, that had tangible effects on people's quality of life. We split the atom, discovered evolution, we unlocked the secrets of DNA. And this progress wasn't just technological, right? So the material abundance actually allowed us to have social and moral progress as well. So political liberalism, abolition, the extension of the franchise, education and healthcare for everyone. Like, these are all things that were distinctly British. I think that it's important to remind ourselves that our legacy was one of progress. It's true that recently we have stagnated. So you see that economic growth has slowed, investment is low. For the first time in living history, children are probably going to be worse off than their parents. And this is something that's a modern phenomenon. Like, the last time we've seen this much stagnation, it was 200 years ago, when defeating Napoleon led us to a period of like relative peace. So my controversial claim was that this didn't just happen. We chose this. So we chose stagnation. In our essay, we talk about three broad choices that have constrained our potential. The first one's conservatism over dynamism. The second's borrowing over building. And then the third's impotence over courage. And I invite people to go and read the essay. I know it's quite long, but we kind of talk through those points in detail. But what I'll maybe do is give a more general picture. Essentially, we think that the biggest problem in the UK is that building is hard. It's hard to build infrastructure. It's hard to build homes. It's hard to build companies. And this wasn't always the case. But not building actually has tangible impacts on people's lives, ordinary people's lives. Not building infrastructure means, for example, energy and water bills are high. Not building homes means rent is high. But there's also this like bigger economic problem, right? Like, when we fail to build, we create conditions where rent seeking thrives, where people win and gain not by actually creating value for others, but by adjusting the rules to entrench their own advantage. For example, so a really good example is in the housing market. Many landowners think it's more profitable to block development than to invest in new sources of prosperity. And that creates an economy where you're actually inheriting a lot more than wealth than you are creating wealth. So as the economy tilts towards what we would call rentierism, you actually have these like pretty perverse incentives throughout the system, which means businesses and workers are making decisions that aren't necessarily like good for the system. Productive firms struggle to build, which means they struggle to recruit the best talent. So the best talent either goes elsewhere. We're actually the fifth largest producer of US tech unicorns. And then like the talent that does stay ends up in like inefficient sectors. And that like to the detriment of society. Essentially the link between wealth and producing value to society, what economists will call productivity, is broken. And we think that like, you also see this in government, right? Like, what else is broken? The machinery of the state's also broken. This is what we talk about in our courage and impotence section. And Dominic Cummings talks about this, although we think that like his conclusions are a little bit too destructive. Like, that there's a more productive way you can look at this. But effectively, getting things done in government is almost impossible. Like, you have responsibility everywhere but nowhere. No authority isn't like separated from accountability, and like you can't implement the decisions you make. We basically think that all of this culminates in a stagnant society.
So obviously, you're not making any profit by the work you're doing. So how exactly do you get funded? Where does that money come from that enables you to do your work?
So we're 100% funded philanthropically. That means that foundations and personal donations fund our work. We don't take money from industry. We don't take money from government. And this allows us also to have complete research freedom. So all of our funding is unrestricted, which means our research isn't impacted by our funders.
It'd be great to hear now about the story of how you decided to co-found this organization. So I know you're involved in something before. This seems like a bit of a continuation of it, UK day one. But at least perhaps just the last couple of years, how did you end up getting the interest to do this project and then set it up?
In some ways, it's a slightly random path. So I started UK Day One with my co-founder, David, about a year and a half ago. And UK Day One was focused on crowdsourcing policy ideas from people in the innovation and science and tech ecosystems. Our insight there was that you have the same people feeding into policy. SW1s are highly insular, and we wanted to sort of break up, basically add a little bit more chaos and new ideas into the ecosystem, break up sort of a stagnating policy ecosystem. And to some extent, that was only supposed to be a year-long project. I was actually supposed to be going to do law school in America. It was all set. It was not even my full-time job. At the same time, I also had helped set up this philanthropic fund. Slowly it grew, and it became very obvious that we had found, I guess, what startup founders call product market fit. People were really interested in some of the ideas that we were pushing for. At some point, I remember being in number 10, and I'm sat next to David, and I turn around to him and I say, "Well, gosh, I'm not going to law school, am I?" He was like, "Yeah, no, you're not. We're going to start a thing. Like, we're going to build this." And lots of people had sort of thought that there was a gap in the think tank ecosystem for an organization like the Center for British Progress. Nobody was building it. It's like, and I've been in this situation quite a few times in my life where I'm like, this thing should exist. Okay, let's just do it. This is like a bit of a meme in the policy ecosystem, the phrase, you can just do things. Yeah, but like, you actually can just do things.
Why do you think you are passionate about this particular kind of work? Not just maybe the fact that you're involved in kind of policy and think tanks, but even specifically this idea of progress. Can you break that down at all, where this idea comes from?
I think I probably have the strangest path to working in British politics of people in around me, at least. I'll be slightly biographical about this, because I'm almost trying to like figure out this question for myself beyond like me being object level interested in this work and enjoying building organizations. Why do I care about this so much? So my mum's Brazilian, and she was born in a family. She was one of six born to a single mother in rural Brazil, and she was able to get like this incredible social mobility just because she was able to go to school. She was the first to finish her schooling. My father was, his family were like moved from Europe to Argentina right before World War II because they were being persecuted for their political views. And then in Argentina, similarly, was able to get social mobility from studying, but also had to leave because of the dictatorship in Argentina. So then he left, and both my families then my parents met, and then they were also leaving for places where like there was more economic opportunities. And I was kind of thinking like, well, what were they running towards? Or I guess what was the opposite of what they were running away from? And it was liberal institutions, fair systems, economic opportunities and material advancements. And you sort of see how those things really matter for life outcomes. And I know this because pretty much you get like this almost like A-B testing of lives. At every stage, you can look at people in my family, like the people who were able to leave and the people that weren't able to leave, and compare their lives to mine. And ultimately, I was able to go to Oxford University when my grandmother was barely literate. And it's like quite sweet. You go to her house and she's got this like huge photo of me and like matriculating. It's quite embarrassing with a bunch of candles. And it's like, it looks like I've died. But like that means so much to them. If I think about like what I really care about, it's about building and strengthening these things. I care about progress because I care about people being able to access opportunities and build better lives. And when I came to the UK, so I came to study at Oxford and I've stayed here ever since. I grew up in Hong Kong, so I already had some connection to the UK. I saw a place where the values I've always grown up with were like really like central to the way people saw their country. And I don't think you see this in many places. You see this in Europe to some extent, but Europe's also stagnating and maybe has like some issues that are a little bit more entrenched. I don't think you see all of the values that I care about in the US. And you definitely don't see them in many parts of Asia. Growing up, I saw like Hong Kong change very much when China took power, and some of the things I valued really be taken away. So it's like, I think the UK is a place where I can like fight for these things that I think are really important for human progress, and also make sure that it's a place from which we can continue to export these ideas, which historically we have done, to other places around the world.
What do you get up to exactly each day at work? It obviously changes, and you know you've talked a bit about some of the work your organization does, but can you describe at all a typical day or week? Perhaps there isn't a typical one. You know, just some of the kind of activities you get up to, so someone can kind of envision it a bit more.
It's a very dynamic workplace, which I love. A lot of what I would say personally, a lot of what I do is building the organization, making sure that people in the team feel happy, like that they're working on the things that they want to be working on. It's a lot of like boring operational work as well. And then I would say about 40% of what I do day to day is actual research. So, and often the timelines on these are really quick. So people might think that you start out with like a research plan and you're sitting down and saying, okay, in the next month, I'm going to research these three topics. It's not necessarily like that. Some of the pieces of research we do kind of look like that. Sometimes it's someone calls me and says, I need a one pager on X topic by the end of tomorrow. Can you give us your take on this? And then we go off and we do the best job we can to come up with the best take we can on X topic and send it off in within a short timeline. So it's very difficult to, I think it's like managing both these short term wins or things that you need to get done, and then the long term vision you have towards the output you want to create.
So I want to ask you a few more questions about your kind of story and journey. So undergrad was at University of Oxford. One little thing I wanted to pick up on was that you're the vice president of the Oxford Union Debate and Society. Obviously, this is like a well-known society. What was your experience like there? What did you do exactly? And how has just practicing debating yourself been something that has changed you in any way?
I think I was a very naive international student in the sense that I did debating at school and I loved it. I thought I was actually very shy in some senses. So practicing speaking in public was really good to get me out of my shell. Then I went to university and there was this society that was felt very grand and exciting, that did this thing that I cared about. So I joined, and I remember very clearly that the only reason I ran in elections was because someone sat me down and thought I was going to run and didn't want me to run, and said to me that they didn't think I could win. And that's the only reason why I spent 2 years of my life like dedicating myself so much to this organization, just because one person told me I couldn't do it, which might not be the right way to make decisions looking back, but I am grateful I did do it. There are many negatives to like, there are many ways that the Oxford Union can be very toxic and it's very political, but ultimately I learned so much. It got me out of my shell. It got me speaking to people, canvassing, organizing large teams, things that I don't think I was inherently very good at.
You went to LSE afterwards to do a master's. What did you study and research there exactly?
So I did public policy, and I also did lots of courses in economics. My thesis was actually looking at tax havens and tax havens responses to the OECD BEPS proposal. And no, I really enjoyed my time at LSE. At the same time, I was also running sort of a consulting business where it was just of one, it was just me. So I was, I had the like flexibility living in London to like fly out to startups and alongside my studies also do these really cool projects where I was hiring or building out strategies for startups around Europe. And that was really, really fun.
So one thing I noticed on your LinkedIn as well, on the way, is you seem to have been involved in kind of the development of three apps: Find My Pasta, Sync for Spotify, and like the app for the Oxford Union Debating Society. How come you have been involved in so many apps? What's all this about?
At university, I had a very good friend, and both of us liked to build things when we found problems that we were annoyed with. None of these apps were apps that we thought would be commercially successful. I mean, one's a wrapper app for Spotify, building a product that Spotify then, like a year later, built themselves internally. Obviously, that was never going to make money. So there's no moat. But I think that that experience was really interesting for me. It's like just back to that, like, you can just do things mentality. It's like very, very empowering to see a problem and then fix it for yourself. So I really enjoyed building those products. Find My Pasta, I think, was also one that could have gone somewhere. So we were looking at like grocery stores during COVID. There was lots of spikes in demand and drops in supply for different products. So we were looking at grocery stores and like trying to predict demand and supply shocks due to stockpiling, but also due to effects on the supply chain. And that was really fun and a little bit more technical. But I think that the apps were they were kind of just like side projects, really.
You've done a few other things, obviously, between LSE and UK Day One, Smith Futures and Talent Mobility Fund and Renaissance Philanthropy. Can you talk us about any more experiences you've had, perhaps some of the highlights you had in those few years?
Yeah, so Smith Futures actually came out of some of the consulting work I was doing, and I ended up working with them for a lot longer. So Schmidt Futures is a philanthropy by Eric and Wendy Schmidt. So Eric was the CEO of Google, and I was mostly doing science and tech policy research and helping fund projects that were focused on science and tech for good. And I also did a lot of fundraising, which at the time I didn't think was that interesting. I was like, oh, like this is the silly thing that I have to do. And it ended up being the best education I've had. Being able to raise money for your ideas is such a, like, I think, underrated skill. And I am very grateful to have been put on what I thought was a really boring job at the time, but ended up being the most impactful thing that I've learned going forward. The Talent Mobility Fund also kind of came out of Schmidt Futures. I met this woman called Amy Nice, who is, the number one expert in the US on STEM immigration and high-skilled immigration. And together we created this philanthropic fund that funds, a funder of other projects. So we would fund projects that unlocked opportunities for people to move to places of opportunity without having policy changes. So it would look like, how do you get, in the US context, how do you get more people to consider the O-1, which is like the their superstar visa? And that was really interesting and also something that I'm really passionate about, which is allowing people to move to places of opportunity to both enhance their own work, but also enhance them and their family's livelihoods. And then out of Schmidt Futures, the team that I was working with started this organization called Renaissance Philanthropy that I now help them out on the UK side by being part of their board of directors. But RenPhil is a fantastic organization. They're really focused on progress in science and tech, but from a philanthropic perspective, they raise money from high net worth individuals and then sort of fund and seed organizations both in the UK and in the US. I think now they're thinking about expanding to India as well. In the UK, for example, they work quite closely with ARIA, which is the Advanced Research and Invention Agency.
The point you said about funding was super interesting. Why has learning and becoming more educated into how to raise money for yourself been, as you say, maybe one of the biggest lessons you've learned? What has that taught you?
So I think being able, it's both like a sales point and also a getting the resources to build whatever you want to build point. I think there's some, you learn a lot from being able to articulate your vision and then also being able to close deals and also deal with rejection. These are all things that I don't think I was that great at beforehand. But yeah, getting the resources, knowing that you can get the resources to build whatever you need to build is a superpower. And it also allows me to help other people quite a bit as well. So when I meet people, I tend to try to ask them what's their most ambitious idea. And I think, and then if they come out with that, I try to encourage them that they could get that done. If they then send me a one pager within a week, I tend to then try to help them fund the idea. And that's like incredible because it's like I'm able to help other people build things. And yeah, I think it's like such a accelerator of ambition.
You talked a few times about interacting with ambitious people or encouraging ambitious people. I'm intrigued. What have you learned about people's ambition? Do most people underestimate their ability and their potential and how much ambition they can have? Does it really vary per person? Like, any thoughts around that?
I think most people underestimate how much they can get done, myself included. So this is something, one of the best things you can do is convince people that, like, ask them to like push their ambition a little bit higher. And when I talk about ambition, it's like, it can be ambition in anything, right? It's not necessarily just about making money or about building cool things. It's also, I like to think about ambition in terms of like who you are as a person or like what kinds of things you want to develop in you. I'm ambitious, for example, about how many books I want to read in a year because I care about this as a hobby. So I think like that's one thing, that you can always get more done than you think you can. So you can do a great service to people by pushing them to think about what's like the 2x or 10x version of whatever you're thinking about. And then the other thing is that it's very mimetic, right? So surrounding yourself by people that are ambitious will increase your ambition as well. And I think a lot of humans are mimetic creatures. This is like, my mother used to always say this, like, you have to pick your friends carefully. If they're kind, you'll be kind. If they're not kind, you won't be kind. And when I was a teenager, I thought this was very silly. But turns out that mums tend to be right about things.
That's some good wisdom. Thanks. So a couple of final questions about yourself, having kind of looked at your story. I'm intrigued. What do you do outside of work to unwind?
So I read a lot. I also do quite a bit of exercise. I think I used to be a big runner growing up. I used to almost run semi-professionally, and now I'm trying to get back into it. And then I like to travel a lot. So whenever I can, I do that. Often alone as well. I quite like going solo traveling.
Interesting. What or who have been some kind of key sources of inspiration in your life? Perhaps people, personal, famous books, maybe in your case, you seem inspired by. But yeah, anything here?
Proust was my biggest inspiration growing up. As in many ways, he's not a very flattering figure, right? He was a bit of a snob and he was obsessive about his work. He, for the last years of his life, lived in a cork-lined room, not seeing anyone, just sitting and writing and rewriting this like fantastic novel. But his monomaniacal nature and his like focus on building something worthy and good, and in many ways he has succeeded in creating this thing that's wonderful and's touched so many people's lives. I always found that really beautiful. And in a more on a political side of things, I really am quite inspired by Jean Monnet. So he's like the ultimate policy entrepreneur. He was able to basically will the European Union to be created, but not from a position of like sort of structural power. He kind of like was able to move people around and slowly throughout the years make his vision come true. And I think that that's also incredibly inspirational.
just whilst we're there, I want to ask briefly about Proust. I've never read, but I've always heard about, I believe, one of his long-ish works is In Search of Lost Time or something like that. I guess you've read that. What are your thoughts on that? I've heard lots of good things and lots of, this is a very, very long book. I can't finish it.
Yeah, I don't think, I think you should, you don't have to read all of it. That's my take. It's a very, very long book. I think it's beautiful. It takes a lot of focus to read it, because it's all these like long winding sentences. There are pages and pages of descriptions. I don't think you need to read the whole book from start to finish. I also think it's okay if your eyes glaze over slightly when you're reading a very long sentence about how the light reflects off of the water. But I do think that there's something, two things that I think are really interesting about the text. I think it's really good at understanding humans and how humans interact. I think Proust was incredibly interested in societies and interactions and how, like, yeah, the horrible sides of humanity, but also the beautiful sides of humanity. And I also think that reading it can be a meditative act, especially when you're reading the really boring bits. Sometimes if you focus on a thing for long enough, your mind enters this kind of flow state. And people talk about this when they're producing things, the flow state of production. I think the flow state of production is really interesting and really amazing. I try to get that in my work as well, although it's a bit harder when your work's more dynamic. But I think there's also the flow state of consumption that's a little bit more separate from your ego or who you are. And I think that's something that I really love to achieve. And I think Proust helps at least me achieve that.
Oh, fascinating. That's great. Okay, and if you had 1 hour with the Prime Minister, if you had to convince him of one thing, one idea, maybe something to implement policy-wise, what would that be?
You mentioned this in passing, but I think energy is one of the biggest things that we're facing as a country. So by many measures, we're the most energy-starved nation in the world. So between 2004 and 2021, so this is before the invasion of Ukraine, our industrial energy prices have tripled in nominal terms, or doubled in terms of consumer prices. So we're like paying about 118% more than French businesses for our energy costs. If you want to reindustrialize, if you want to have a country that's able to take charge of this AI revolution, if you want people's bills to go down, you have to fix this energy problem. And this impacts both households, who rate the cost of living as what they think should be the government's top priority, and businesses that are being constrained in their scaling and in their growth by this super high cost of energy. I think that should be our number one focus as a nation, at least for the next 5 to 10 years. We do need to decarbonize. So I believe in climate change. I think it's a huge problem, but it cannot come at the cost of lowering energy bills. And there are ways that you can do both these things, right? We talk a lot about nuclear power. We talk a lot about, investing in batteries, investing in renewables, and building more capacity on the grid. That's the one thing that I think needs to be getting more focus on.
So on to the final question. I always keep this the same every show, ask every guest the same question to end. Julia, what do you think about, what does it mean to live a good life?
Well, very earnest question. I feel like whatever I say will be slightly naff. But I always think about my life in terms of truth, beauty, and love. And like, if you follow those things, like, you'll probably be fine.
Love it. All right, well, great. Julia, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really interesting and inspiring to speak to you. Appreciate the work you're doing, and good luck with your new organization.
Thank you so much, Jim.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview. If you did, please support the channel by hitting the subscribe button below. See you next time.